The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit. Welcome to Sherlock Mondays. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we're going on a biblioventure through the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 26, The Adventure of the Greek Interpreter, and joining me as co-host again is Curtis Armstrong. Hey, Curtis.
Hey, how are you doing, Ed?
I'm like jittery. I think it's the Mycroft thing. I think it's like, woohoo!
Yeah, it's a big deal. The Mycroft thing is a big deal.
It certainly is. And, you know, you get so little of them. So when you get them in a story, boom, yeah, especially the first one. So I'm very excited to talk about Mycroft with you. And we only have a few shows left, you know.
Yes, that's right.
We have five more shows of Sherlock Mondays to deduce, decipher, dissect Sherlock Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson, in our kind of conversational annotation. If you are watching live right now, I'd please ask you to like and subscribe to this channel. Like these videos, subscribe to this channel, have fun in the live chat. If you're watching the recording, please do the same. Doing those things, liking the videos, subscribing to our channel gives us greater visibility, lets us grow the audience. And Sherlock Mondays is also an audio podcast, so thank you to all of our podcast listeners as well. I'd also ask everyone if you would please consider making a donation to the Rosenbeck. If you have already donated or joined as a member, thank you so much. That's how we get to do these shows for free, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. And if you have not already donated or become a member, I invite you to do so. I will tell you all about how to register for our special subscription-only Hound of the Baskerville shows at the mid-break today. You're going to be on that too, right, Curtis?
That's correct.
All righty. And I'm also giving, for those who live in the Philadelphia area, I'm giving a behind-the-bookcase tour of the Sherlock Holmes materials and a couple other mystery-related things in our collections coming up soon in April, on April 4th. If you've ever wanted to hold a Sherlock manuscript in your hands and meet me all at the same time, well, this is your chance. There's still a few slots available for that. But before we start our discussion tonight, Curtis, guess what I'm drinking? It's Greek Interpreter.
It looks like ouzo to me.
Ouzo is in this. Yes, ouzo, honey, lemon, and mint, muddled up mint, and I threw a sprig in there too. Every episode features a Sherlock tale designed by our good friend and co-host, Mary El Caro. You can find the recipes in the YouTube description for the episode. I also send out the recipe via email every week for those who are registered for the show. You can register at the Sherlock Mondays homepage on rosenbeck.org. And tonight we're just celebrating the Greek. So it's Opa all night with ouzo. Oh, and she's got a great title for it. It's called Sophie's Choice.
Oh, excellent title. My God.
Sophie's Choice is delicious. Oh, yeah. All right. Do the ouzo all night long.
Yikes.
Mary also had a comment on this, that ouzo is a dry anise forward spirit that is widely consumed in Greece. It gained popularity in the mid-19th century after the Greek Revolution of 1821, which led to Greece gaining its independence from the Ottoman Empire. And today, the date we're airing this show, this is Greek Independence Day, March 25th.
I didn't know that.
I just put it together. So we're doing the show. So happy Independence Day for all the Greeks out there.
Yep.
Well,
not all ouzo.
A giant jug full. You've got that to be, so we can't see.
That would be overdoing it.
Well, let's jump right into the story tonight. We've got lots to cover in this. We have shared a PDF of a facsimile of The Adventure of the Greek Interpreter as it was originally published in the September 1893 issue of the Strand magazine. You can download that on the Rosebeck's Sherlock Mondays page. And it's adventure number 22, Curtis. And it begins, during my long and intimate acquaintance with Sherlock Holmes, I had never heard him refer to his relations and hardly ever to his own early life. And then that's what we get, obviously. Some of these stories, we get this. This is why I've chosen to tell this story. But this one, we're right into a biographical tidbit about Sherlock. Well, Watson has said that these are the memoirs, well, his memoirs, but they wind up really being memoirs about Sherlock, more than Watson even. And we get to find out some things that we haven't found out. It's odd, Curtis, isn't it, to be this deep into a character and not have these kinds of details?
Well, I mean, I think going back and looking at this book in preparation for this, it struck me again that the strange thing about Holmes is he and Watson have lived together for years, and by Watson's account, he has never mentioned anybody in his family that he has any relations at all. And which adds to, as Watson says, not exactly in these words, but adds to the sort of sense of otherworldliness about Holmes's character, that he was just this creation, this thing that existed outside of a regular family unit. Mm-hmm. And when they start having this conversation this late in the game, and Holmes reveals to Watson that he has a brother several years older who's even more brilliant than he, I mean, it's a great way of snagging your audience at the top.
Yeah.
Is saying, you know, oh my God, someone even more brilliant. And he goes on to explain, of course, that the reason that no one knows that he exists and is more brilliant is because he's indolent and he doesn't, you know, he sits alone in his chair and deduces things from a distance, right? So it's an interesting thing to do, to introduce a character with that kind of fascinating introduction this late in the game, not just late in this series of stories, but the other thing that we have in retrospect to realize is that Doyle is one story away from killing off Sherlock Holmes.
He is.
And this is when he chooses to do it. And for several reasons, which we can go into later, I think the reason that he introduced Mycroft at this point was because he was running dry and he needed to do something to keep people interested, and this was the idea.
It is a fascinating wrinkle, and it's even, I find it even more interesting that Watson himself in a sense comments on the fact that on how interesting it is, like that it's a new wrinkle, and he talks about how it kind of creates, because Sherlock never talks about his family, it's made him, so he says, it increased the somewhat inhuman effect he produced upon me, that he was an isolated phenomenon, a brain without heart, deficient in human sympathy, doesn't like to form new friendships, unemotional character. And the fact that Watson's saying the fact that he never talked about any kind of past family life kind of intensified these views about him. And then suddenly Holmes just says, he says that he has a brother. And it happened, after tea on a summer evening, they have this digressive conversation about golf clubs, the obliquity of the ecliptic, and atavism and hereditary aptitudes. I love that mix of, you know, conversational things there. Of course, I have to ask, does Sherlock golf? I think this is the Is this the only golf reference? I didn't look up if it was the only golf reference, but it's the only one so far.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that. But obviously he does that, you know, the introduction of three really disparate discussions, subjects, leaving for the last the one which introduces the whole subject about the idea of atavism and the hereditary connections. That is the perfect segue into his talk about his brother,
and also the obliquity of the ecliptic, this kind of thing in astronomy. This was astronomy nil was what Watson's first introduction to Sherlock was, and now we have these other things that we've learned that Sherlock's a polymath, really, is what he is. As the stories have developed, Doyle's really made him a polymath. But this idea of atavism, which for those who don't know, is that kind of, it's like the resurfacing of primitive traits in humans. And this was a late 19th century anxiety. After Darwin, this kind of fear of devolution, that this idea that, we'd become more primitive tendencies would come back in our civilized society. And it was also a big part of criminology. And Doyle knows this and has read about this stuff, this kind of scientific approach to criminal behavior. But which would, of course, have terrible consequences in the development of eugenics into the 20th century. But that whole, it's all about morality. It always strikes me, Curtis, it's about trying to situate morality into biology, and this really troubled the people in the late 19th century that there could be moral consequences to the development of humans.
Yeah, and that's certainly true, and it reflects concerns and interests that Doyle had at the time as a scientific man and as a creative writer and all that. But it's also just a way of getting into what he really wants to talk about, which is Holmes as a brother.
Yeah.
So, and by using the three, I mean, this goes back, to Study in Scarlet, the idea that they have these wide-ranging conversations on all sorts of subjects, which gives you a sense of how intelligent and well-read they both are, and how close they are, that they can sit around for hours talking on all different subjects.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a good sense of what their relationship was.
Well, he surprises him here. Watson thinks that he's just brilliant because of his training, and Sherlock then says, well, my ancestors were country squires, so we do get a little bio for Sherlock. And also, he says, my turn that way, meaning this kind of observation and deduction, my turn that way is in my veins and may have come with my grandmother, who was the sister of Vernet, the French artist. Art in the blood is liable to take the strangest forms.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating line.
Well, and one of the most famous Sherlock Holmes lines in the whole canon. Absolutely.
And there were actually French painters. It was like a grandfather, a father, and a son, all painters. Now, whether or not Doyle was really referring to them or was just throwing out a French name, I don't know if we know.
It's a curious thing to do because the Vernets were still around at the time. It's something that, on television you could never get away with.
Yeah.
The idea of connecting a fictional character to living people. And is it Jean-Claude? I can't remember. I have to look it up again. But
Horace Vernet was
Horace.
It would have to be the one if you line up this time period, and if it was
right.
The mother as the sister.
He yeah.
Famous for painting scenes and that's historical subjects.
It's interesting that he did that. And it never.
He did die in 1863. So we're at least past him. So.
Yeah. And he never brings it up again. I mean, the idea of being connected with you know, this legendary French dynasty of painters.
Here's a self-portrait of Vernet. There you go. Now that looks like that could have been, he could be related. Look at that pipe. Look at that tremendous pipe there. Some Eastern kind of pipe he's got, and he's got this, you know, their fascination with Orientalism. And this painter was, of course, famous for doing battle scenes and historical costuming and stuff like that. But yeah, this guy could have been, you know, Sherlock's great uncle, right? Yeah, great uncle he would have been. Art in the blood is liable to take the strangest forms. And what I also like about that, Curtis, is that it begs the question for me, is the way Holmes practices detection, is that artistic?
No, I think it's primarily scientific.
That's what I think too, yeah.
Yeah, but it manifests itself in a different way.
Yeah.
I think art in the blood is liable to take the strangest forms, but Watson has just been talking about these other subjects, including the obliquity of the ecliptic. Yeah. That I mean they're going from one thing to another in this conversation. So it has to do, in this case, you've got golf, which is, you know, a physical sport, and this scientific discussion, which is in there, and then you wind up with art in the blood and manifesting itself in this scientific way. On the other hand, you know, Holmes was himself a writer and an actor, so he had strong artistic sensitivity as well. So, yeah.
And that way that he has to creatively, I mean, it's creativity when he has to imagine the events as they were occurring. I mean, he takes the clues and then he has to imagine it as a story, in a sense, or as a narrative of events. And I think that may play a role into it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he says, Mycroft is even better at this than he is. Of course, Watson's like, oh, you shouldn't be humble. And Holmes is like, to a logician, all things are exactly as they are. Like, I got no time for humility. It's just what it is. Mycroft is better at this than I am. He's 7 years a senior, as you commented. Well known in his own circle, which is the Diogenes Club. And more on that in a minute, because I want to share this Paget picture and do a little bit of a rabbit hole on the chair in it.
Okay, carry away.
Here we go. This is the first Paget illustration for this story. The two of them sitting here, and Holmes has got his little pipe, talking to Watson, and it's this fascinating looking chair here, which is looks like it's a wicker chair. It's not mentioned in the story. So Paget has placed this chair in here. There's no mention. There's like a basket chair mentioned in a late story, but that's not this chair. That's a different kind of chair. But this chair, Curtis, looks just like a chair in another story. And actually, you were on this, the stockbroker's clerk, and except Paget has changed the bottom of it. And where is that? Let me share that. Oh, this is the picture of Vernet. Look, this is the chair in this story on the right with the four legs on the bottom. And here's the chair as a rocker that Paget has drawn it. This is at Watson's. Watson and Sherlock must shop at the same furniture store, but Watson went for the rocker and Sherlock went for the floor, the feet on the floor here. And what I have discovered, Curtis, is this is a chair of Paget's that he, you know, of course, as he's drawing, you know, he uses his brother as a model for Holmes originally, and he has to draw. There's another chair. I think it might be this chair that Watson's on on the right here in this story is also a chair that we know that Paget owned. But in the 1951 Sherlock Holmes exhibition in London, they recreated the sitting room. And in that sitting room, they placed this chair in front of the fire, which was donated by Paget's daughter. And this was Paget's chair right here. And you can see the design of it here. This is the chair that he was drawing. But it is 4 feet on the floor. He had made it a rocker for stockbroker. And there it is, Paget's chair. And I think then it wound up in the Sherlock Holmes Museum. I don't know if it's still there. Maybe somebody that's been there recently in the chat can say if this chair is still there. Or I wonder where this chair wound up in the end. But that was Paget's chair. All righty. So, thank you. I was just fascinated with it. As soon as I saw the chair in the story, I'm like, wait, that's a chair in another story. And then you head down the rabbit hole, which I love.
Right.
Nothing like a rabbit hole. Nothing like a Sherlock story for good rabbit holes about chairs. Well, now Sherlock says, oh, well, let's, Watson's never heard of the Diogenes Club. And then he describes it as the queerest club in London and Mycroft, one of the queerest men. Now that's a term that's, of course, we have a different definition of queer now these days. Then it just meant the oddest. But, you know, I did find it fascinating, Curtis, in the Jeremy Brett Granada series, they change it to oddest because I think that they realize people will hear it differently now. But, hey, I don't mind hearing it that way either. And Mycroft is there from 4:45 till 7:40. So he's a person who has this strict schedule that he sticks to, doesn't vary it. And Holmes then takes Watson to the club to visit. And this time that he's there, this 4:45 to 7:40, I guess that's like a, you know, after work, go to the club, have dinner, relax and stay.
You mean at the Diogenes Club?
Yeah, that's the time of day he goes. What's the day for most men in this era when they visited their clubs?
I guess, yes. To me, the most interesting thing is the description, Holmes's description of it. There are many men in London, you know, who, some from shyness, some from misanthropy, have no wish for the company of their fellows, yet they are not averse to comfortable chairs, the latest periodicals. It is for the convenience of these that the Diogenes Club was started, and it now contains the most unsociable and unclubbable men in town. No member is permitted to take the least notice of any other. Save in the stranger's room, no talking is, under any circumstances, allowed, and three offenses, if brought to the notice of the committee, render the talker liable to expulsion. I mean, it's such a great description of this weird club of people who don't like other people.
Because it's not even just silence. It's like they're not even supposed to notice. You can't take the least notice of anyone.
Do not notice that anyone else is there. Sit in your chair, read your newspaper, have your drink, and go home.
Yeah.
And pay for the privilege. I mean, it's great.
Oh, he also gives us another tidbit about Mycroft, which we don't really get to explore in this story, but this will come in a later story as people continue to read the Sherlock Holmes stories later when Mycroft comes back. This Mycroft What he has is an extraordinary faculty for figures, and he audits the books in some of the government departments. So that's all. We'll leave it at that now. I don't want to spoil anything for anyone else in the future. But Holmes does importantly say, what is to me a means of livelihood, this criminal detection, what is to me a means of livelihood is to him the merest hobby of a dilettante. And that will come into play later when Hal Mycroft reacts to this investigation as it goes on. Also, the Diogenes Club, Curtis, as you know, this is a, especially for readers of Doyle's time who have all had the classical education, Diogenes is the Greek philosopher who was a cynic and a misanthrope and lived by himself and had a dog. A dog was okay, but people know. So that's they've named the club after the famous Greek cynic philosopher who didn't, he lived in a jar in the town square or something like that and didn't like to associate with people. Well, they visit the club, and Holmes also finds it a very soothing atmosphere. That makes sense for him, right? He just, everybody shut up while I'm thinking. So that's what he wants to do. They visit and they see all the men there reading their papers, not paying attention to each other. And then we meet Mycroft, and let me share the picture of him. Paget's illustration of Mycroft. And here he is. Definitely larger than Sherlock, but in the description, this, you know, I'm surprised he's not fatter. Very much larger and stouter than Sherlock. His body was absolutely corpulent, but his face, though massive, had preserved something of the sharpness of expression, which was so remarkable in that of his brother. His eyes, which were of a peculiarly light watery gray, seemed to always retain that faraway introspective look which I had only observed in Sherlock's when he was exerting his full powers. I would have thought that Paget would have drawn him a little bigger than this. So, but this is our first glimpse of Mycroft. He does see, I think he captures that face in the way he's described it, that sharpness of expression. You could see a little bit of his Sherlock in that face.
Yeah.
Well, he meets them, and the first thing he says is, first he puts out his broad, flat hand like the flipper of a seal. Like, really? I mean, that's big. That's a big person, bigger than I think what I've been drawn here. But, and he has got this great comment, I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became his chronicler to Watson. So, and then another... another kind of meta moment in the story, because the readers, of course, read these chronicles. And so it's all, again, like, this is...
So they know Mycroft is a fan.
Yes. And he reads them. He reads these stories about Sherlock. We get an unpublished case mentioned. The Manor House case. Mycroft says he's surprised Sherlock didn't ask him about it. And then they go in this wonderful back and forth here. No, I solved it. It was Adams, of course. Yes, it was Adams. I was sure of it from the first. You know, like this back, like, this sounds to me like they're competing, you know, that they're already, like, this is what these brothers have always done.
Right.
You know, and then they proceed to do it looking out the window of the club. In which they, much like Holmes and Watson do at Baker Street frequently, look out the window and observe things and make comments. But this time when they look out and they see these men out there and the billiard maker, the billiard marker and the other, what do you make of the other? And then the old soldier recently discharged, India... You know, recently, they finally get down to recently deceased wife who probably dialed in child and giving birth to which, like, these crazy details that we've seen in stories. We've seen Sherlock do this. now we get the brother team act doing this.
Like, well, I think it's one of the best things in the story, because you get a sense of what they were like growing up, that this was something they did together as children. They competed, and it was always, you know, it was Mycroft urging him to learn and observe and deduce. And it's short, it's succinct, mm-hmm. and it tells you all about the relationship.
Absolutely. I mean, and in that case, then it does seem to, it's not a far, you know, step to think that Sherlock is in a sense shaped by his older brother.
That, oh, I'm sure that's true.
Imagine that this was the thing going on when they were children.
Yeah, very much so.
Mycroft also says, they sit down, they look out the window, and now we're gonna have a Poe digression here, an Edgar Allan Poe digression. He says, to anyone who wishes to study mankind, this is the spot. Look at the magnificent types. And then they're observing people outside the window. I'm pretty certain this is a nod to a specific Poe story, and that's called Man of the Crowd. Man of the Crowd was a brief description of it. It begins with a man sitting in a coffee shop in London, looking out the window, and he starts to categorize all the people he sees, the innumerable varieties of figure, dress, air, gait, visage, and expression of countenance. This is exactly things that Holmes does. This is not a Dupin story either. He describes various clerks, and he could tell the difference between the lower clerks and the upper clerks, the pickpockets, the gamblers, the peddlers, all these things. And he describes the characteristics of these people just by observing how they look, how they walk, and this. So this is a very, what has become a Sherlockian thing now, but this is a thing that Doyle has borrowed heavily from Poe. And the entire story, Man of the Crowd, is about reading people. And this narrator, who we never know his name, he sees a man in the crowd, and he says about him, during the brief minute of my original survey to form some analysis of the meaning conveyed, there arose confusedly and paradoxically within my mind the ideas of vast mental power, of caution, of penuriousness, of avarice, of coolness, of malice, of bloodthirstiness, of triumph, of merriment, of excessive terror, of intense, of supreme despair. This is the person he sees out the window, and this is what he sees in him. It's almost like he's looking at Moriarty, right? This, you know, for me now, like having that overlay, reading Sherlock. And then he leaves the coffee shop, and he obsessively follows this man of the crowd all night and all through the next day. And then finally, as the next night is coming on, he says, I grew wearied unto death, and stopping fully in front of the wanderer, gazed at him steadfastly in the face. He noticed me not, but resumed his solemn walk, while I, ceasing to follow, remained absorbed in contemplation. This old man, I said at length, is the type and genius of deep crime. We really know that Doyle admired and writes about Poe stories. He writes about the gold bug. He mentions Dupin and all this. I wish we had a mention of Man of the Crowd in some work of his, because I just, there's so many little parallels between that story and just this whole idea of Sherlock and observation, and then latching on to this one evil character is really fascinating for me. And the story, Man of the Crowd, is also this kind of fascinating commentary on what will, in a sense, become the mystery detective story. But this story, unlike the Dupin stories, doesn't have a mystery. Well, it doesn't have a specific crime for him to solve. And it winds up being this philosophical thing on chasing evil and being able to recognize it, and then maybe the futility of that. It's a brilliant story and well worth your time, everyone. So, all righty. There's a chair break. Now it's a Poe break. All right, now on back to the story. I love digressions. Clearly. Back to Mycroft and Sherlock. Mycroft also takes snuff. I think that's interesting. Anytime I see people taking snuff at this time, late 19th century, I find it interesting because it's really going away. It's not as common as it used to be, and it's rarely, it's almost always a kind of dilettantish, you know, aristocratic character taking snuff. So probably not. I'm just missing the other times, but I frequently see that. He's got his snuff in a tortoise shell box. And now's when we finally get a case. Something, you know, is going to happen here. He tells Sherlock he has something quite after your own heart, a most singular problem submitted to my judgment. I really had not the energy to follow it up. That's that, you know, indolent character that we get from the beginning. And he brings in Mr. Melos, a Greek by extraction who's a linguist, and he makes his living partly as an interpreter in the law courts. Have a little ouzo. He comes in, he shakes hands with Sherlock, and he recognizes him. Sherlock's famous. His dark eyes sparkled with pleasure when he understood that the specialist was anxious to hear his... Or doesn't he recognize him? No, he doesn't necessarily recognize him. There's somebody there that is going to hear his story. And that's what he's happy about. Because the police, you know, they have no... They just think this is a story. They can't credit this. He says, I don't believe the police credit me. And then we get Latimer's story. Or we get Melos's story, in which Latimer, who I'm surprised, as I'm sure you are, that he told him his name, a very fashionably dressed young man, Mr. Latimer, comes and takes him in a cab. He threatens him. It's apparently not a job. It's an abduction because they want him to get this information from a Greek person at the place that they're also holding captive. And they drive around for a couple hours. And then he meets the second character here, whose name we're not told till later.
And Kemp.
Kemp, yeah. What's his first name?
Wilson Kemp.
Wilson Kemp, thank you. Who is a small, mean-looking, middle-aged man with rounded shoulders who has this jerky, nervous fashion with some giggling laughs in between, who seems even scarier than the big guy with the, you know, with the weapon who's threatening him. It reminds me of... in the Raiders movie, Curtis, the way he's described, Major Tot, you know, Ronald Lacey played him in the movie where he's, you know, the guy that gets burned on the hand and the Nazi, the little, yeah, he reminds me of him, that kind of giggling little, you know, evil guy that doesn't seem like he'd be that formidable, but you know that he's going to do horrible things to you.
Well, I mean, this story gets kind of strange for me. I don't understand a lot of what happens here. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. And part of it is...
Questioning?
Well, I mean, the whole situation where he is, he's being kidnapped by this person... And I can understand obviously you're trapped in a carriage with a man who is carrying a weapon, and you're obviously going to do what you're told. But then it goes on, and the questioning is peculiar. the way that it's done. Certainly not the easiest way I could imagine to get the information out of these people, out of this person. He winds up, of course, later on being kidnapped by the same person again out of his house. I mean, you know, the page comes up and gets him. He doesn't say, "Oh my God, no, get help." You know, it's like, no, as soon as he sees him, he goes under his spell, which is a peculiar idea. There's a lot about this story that's a little funny to me.
Doyle does try to make the point that he's just not, you know, a brave man, that he's easily, you know.
I know, but that's, it's not enough. To say that that Melas is not a man of great physical courage, which is how Holmes puts it.
Yeah.
No, maybe he's not a man of great physical courage. He's not going to assault the guy in the carriage the first time, but he could get from his room to the street. That he could do it just out of fear is utterly peculiar.
We do have this in meeting the prisoner here, Paul Curtides. Doyle does create this very strange gothic scenario here with his appearance. Deadly pale, terribly emaciated, protruding brilliant eyes, and he's got his face crisscrossed with sticking plaster, and then big large pad over his mouth. This really bizarre image that Doyle has created here. For those who might not realize, sticking plasters are they're basically just bandages that, you know, they have, you know, there's a way that you can make them sticky. And now we have band-aids that are sticky, you know, adhesive bandages, but they were called sticking plasters then.
Right.
And I wonder if this is, you know, this really strange scenario is supposed to take our attention off of the fact that he has him write the things out on a slate.
It's really weird.
Like that doesn't seem to. This would work as an oral conversation, asking extra questions.
I mean, he acknowledges the fact that it was a strange half-written, half-spoken conversation, because this is a man, Paul Curtides, has the bandage across
his mouth. So he has to write because they don't want him to speak. But, they don't want to make noise.
So we're talking about a slate that is probably this size.
Yeah.
And it repeatedly, over and over again, Melas is asking him the questions, and he's writing frantically that he will not sign the papers, he will not do it, you know, do what you like with me, and all of this stuff. And then Melas falls into this idea. He has an idea that he can, because these men don't speak Greek, that he can actually just, you know, add little questions on to the end. And then because they can't read Greek, this guy can answer in a written way to answer these additional questions.
But they need a translator for him to sign a paper, or I'm going to kill you. Like, need a translator.
It's not believable. I'll tell you, this comes back to what I was saying at the beginning. For this story, which has really a fairly high reputation in the canon, I mean, what was the one that we did, right? You know, Stockbroker's Clerk or The Resident Patient. You know, you're going to remember the Greek interpreter. The reason you remember the Greek interpreter has nothing to do with the case.
Yeah.
It has to do with the introduction of Mycroft, but Mycroft disappears in this story. He is introduced in this grand way by Holmes before we actually meet him. Then we actually meet him, and he introduces Melas, who tells the story. And then Holmes and Watson leave, they have nothing else they can do, even though somewhere in London, someone is being starved to death in order to, and a woman is apparently being held hostage. Holmes and Watson go back to Baker Street. In the meantime, Mycroft gets the letter from Jay Davenport saying she's at the Myrtles, this house, so they now maybe know where she is. And when they get back to Baker Street after the meeting, they find Mycroft already there.
Good.
So Mycroft has left after them with this new information. He says to them, I passed you in the carriage, in the hansom. Did he have the hansom driver pull over and hail them and say, this is where they are, let's go? No. He goes to Baker Street, goes upstairs, lights a cigar, and sits down and waits for them.
Yeah.
What happens if they, you know, decided to stop for a drink?
Oh, well, there's other things, too, that'll hit later, too. I want to hit that later, definitely. I mean, I'm 100% with you on this.
There are so many. I mean, just the fact that when he takes Watson to meet Mycroft, and the story of Melos comes up, when Mycroft writes a note and has someone send it to Melos to step across and tell his story. What if Melos hadn't been there? I mean, there are a million of these kind of... It's just all wrong.
I'm going to get to more of that in a bit. Let me actually take a mid-break first, and let me let everyone know, thank everyone for watching this episode. As a nonprofit organization, the Rosenbach Museum and Library depends on the generosity of friends and supporters like you to keep programs like this free and accessible to thousands of fellow Sherlockians worldwide. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbach and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do at our website, or by becoming a member. Membership gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, exclusive invitations to member-only events. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website. We have lots of great in-person programs and courses as well. There's a course on the music of Plato's dialogues that's going to meet at the Rosenbach starting soon. There's an online course on Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. There is a course taught by Julia Wells on David Copperfield in the 21st century. So you also get to do Dickens's Copperfield, Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead, and Armando Iannucci's David Copperfield movie from a few years ago. That's going to be a really great online course. And I mentioned I'm giving a behind the bookcase tour in person at the Rosenbach with our Sherlock Holmes materials, our Empty House manuscript, and other first editions we have. If you've ever wanted to hold a Sherlock manuscript in your hands, this is your chance, and you can meet me. You can register for that on our website, and you don't want to miss our Sherlock Mondays Hound of the Baskervilles Biblioventure. When Sherlock Mondays comes to a close with the adventure of the empty house, we're going to go on one more Sherlockian Biblioventure. It's an exclusive pay-only series this time. So you subscribe to it, and it's going to be 8 episodes, but the same format. Myself and a co-host, Curtis, you're going to be returning for that. You'll be on
at some point, yes.
All of our other co-hosts. It's $80, but if you're a member, it's only $50 to watch these 8 shows. So I think that's a really good deal. And not only do we have our great co-host returning, we're going to have some new co-hosts as well. I'm not going to reveal who they are yet. It's going to be a surprise. Some other great Sherlockians are also going to join us in talking about Hound of the Baskervilles. So many of you have already registered for it. Thank you so much. I can't wait to do it. And pass the word. Spread the word. We'd like to have as many people do this as possible. It really, programs like that enable this program to happen. So I'd love to have most of you there for that. All righty. Back to the story. While they're doing the questioning, while he's finding out this information, He's finding out who he is, his name at least, and Sophie just comes into the room, and she happens to recognize him. The sticking plasters didn't disguise him any. She recognizes her brother, and then they hustle her out. They get the hug first. He rushes into the woman's arms and says her name. Melos is threatened. They give him 5 sovereigns and threaten him with silence. And that's his story. That's the strange story that the police will not. And then they dump him and he has to walk home. But the police won't believe the story. Mycroft says they put an ad in the paper, which would have been in the agony column, I imagine. It's always the front of the paper, the agony column, these kind of weird classified things from the Victorian age, where some of them were just kind of, you know, offering services or almost advertisements. Some of them were just like coded messages. This one just has the information. If anybody knows Paul Catrides from Athens, and a Greek lady whose first name is Sophie, and they give them a code here that they can contact. Holmes is, of course, immediately aware, as Mycroft should have been too. And maybe that's Holmes's point here, that like, you know, you better be careful, Melos, because now they know you've tipped them off.
Well, not only that, but they have specifically told Melos,
yeah,
if you tell anyone, we'll know. And he's already told the police, and he's told Mycroft. And Mycroft, unbelievably, takes out ads in the newspaper. Look, I mean, if ever there was a case of somebody saying, we know what, you know, Wilson Kemp and Harold Latimer are up to, it's this.
Well, I think this rings true with the story and the way Doyle is really making is showing the difference between Mycroft and Sherlock, that Mycroft might be brilliant at figuring stuff out, but he doesn't know how to take the steps to actually solve something because he doesn't do that. He never does. He's not even interested in doing that, really.
He's not interested in saving the life of someone who's being starved to death.
Nope.
He would not be telling this story to Sherlock if Sherlock hadn't, on the spur of the moment, decided to go visit him.
Yeah.
That's where it gets really peculiar in this story, is not only does he do that thing which, you know, is going to broadcast the fact that they know that something is going on, but also he isn't even bothering going to Holmes, who would be the one person, if the police aren't interested, the one person who could maybe solve this is his brother, and he doesn't go to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Holmes right away is on the case. As soon as he leaves, he's sending telegrams to get some answer some questions about this. He and Watson talk about it a bit, doing that thing for the readers, like they discuss the case and kind of sum up some conclusions so far. This is the readers as we're reading a mystery, and Watson does pretty well here. And figuring out what happened, Watson recognizes what's going on, that it's, you know, a sister. He says, carried all, well, he doesn't get it all good. Holmes has to help him with it a little. But he's Holmes. Yeah. He does that. You know, she'd been in England some time, but he had not been in Greece. And, you know, because Latimer didn't understand the language. But Watson, you know, gets the basics. Well,
no, what he suggests is that Sophie had been in England because she spoke English.
Yeah.
And Paul had not because he didn't speak English. But that doesn't even make sense, because Sophie could have learned English in Greece and still have been able to speak it when she came to England. So that's Holmes's suggestion even there doesn't quite ring true.
Well, when they get back to Baker Street, as you mentioned, there's Mycroft sitting smoking in the armchair. He's just so, he doesn't really care about this. His picture there looks a little bigger, but we don't need to, you know, share that. But that's because he's sitting. He's got a bit more of a belly. And even says to Sherlock, "You don't expect such energy from me, do you, Sherlock? But somehow this case attracts me." Well, maybe Curtis, it's because Sherlock is now there. Mycroft feels like he has to also solve it. He can't just let Sherlock go and solve. He said he wasn't interested, but maybe.
Well, I mean, he wouldn't have. He had gotten this further information from Jay Davenport.
Yeah,
the person who answered his
could have just sent the letter to Sherlock. Here, take this over.
Yeah, he could have.
He's at least there, and he does what Sherlock does with the letter. He notices it was written with a J pen on royal cream paper by a middle-aged man with a weak constitution.
Right.
I love those details. And they find out that Sophie was living, and they find out where she is, where she was living. But here's where Mycroft, he says right away, well, let's go to them and find out the rest of the story. And this is the difference between the hobbyist, the dilettante, and the investigator. Mycroft's just interested in learning this whole story and how it plays out and figuring it out. Sherlock's interested in saving people's lives. And he tells Mycroft right away, I think maybe, like, he says, the brother's life, my dear Mycroft, the brother's life is more valuable than the sister's story. I think we should go get Gregson and drive straight out there.
Yeah.
Well, this surprises me too. Well, Sherlock also takes his gun, and then they discover that Melos, they're going to pick him up, but he is left with the small giggling man. So Holmes definitely knows there's trouble now. When does Sherlock ever, Curtis, go and wait for a warrant?
They have to acknowledge the fact that they need a warrant, but
it's never stopped him going to a place and saw, he doesn't do it in Copper Beaches.
Well, no, but if he was taking the police with him,
yeah,
he would need to have a warrant. But yeah, I mean, again, none of this makes sense.
Well, they wind up, they have to wait a whole hour to get the search warrant. I'm really surprised that Sherlock does that.
I'm surprised it only took an hour to get. I mean, it's weird.
Well, they find the birds are flown, the nest is empty. Sherlock even notices the wheel tracks that the carriage has taken the luggage out, because the tracks are lighter and then they're deeper. So he knows that they've fled, finds an open window. He still breaks in. The police aren't even so willing to break into the house. Holmes has to literally go and get in the window and tell them, let's, we can get in the window here. And then they hear the low moaning sound coming from somewhere above our heads. Mycroft followed as quickly as his great bulk would permit. All right. I can go with the other stuff. This I have a real hard time with, Curtis.
What do you mean?
This, like, Bond villain, Batman 60s TV show villain way of killing people. Let me put you guys in a room with charcoal burning so you will slowly die. You know, it's... that moment in the story, I found too silly for me. Like, just pit him over the head and kill him, as they basically done to Paul Kertrides anyway. But they have to suffocate them slowly in a room instead of just killing him.
Yeah.
So, but gives our hero a chance to save at least one of them.
Right.
And they pull out, both of them were blue-lipped and insensible with swollen, congested faces and protruding eyes. and but Paul Catrides why do I keep getting his name messed up here? Catrides, right?
Yeah.
All righty. Paul, it's too late for him. He was in the last stage of emaciation, and he had ceased to moan as we laid him down, and they have come too late, Watson says. Malus, quick, the brandy, right? Ammonia and brandy. Quick, right. The brandy. Watson has this nice little, well, not nice, but this, you know, little poetic metaphor here. I had the satisfaction of seeing him open his eyes and of knowing that my hand had drawn him back from the dark valley in which all paths meet.
Right.
Nice little moment there for Watson, the chronicler. Holmes wouldn't have liked that effect in the story, so. Well, they've saved one. They didn't save Paul. And Sophie's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're reading this first time, you're like, and this was the singular case of the Grecian interpreter. What? It seems like, you know, they give the details here. She was a young lady of wealthy Grecian family, visiting friends. A young man named Harold Latimer acquired an ascendancy over her, persuaded her to fly with him. Wilson Kemp was Latimer's friend, and then they were going to. And then Paul came. Paul finds out her brother, and he comes, and then they're trying to get Paul to sign her fortune over, she, of course, recognizes Paul. She only recognizes Paul because her feminine perceptions, however, had instantly seen through the disguise of a couple bandages on his face. I think, you know, it was just normal people would have just seen that it was her brother. It's her brother. She's going to recognize her brother. And then we get the postscript. Months afterwards, we find out a curious newspaper cutting reached us from Budapest. Who sent the newspaper cutting? I like that idea that there's something interesting going on there that we don't have an answer for. Or maybe Mycroft had it sent. It told how two Englishmen had been traveling with a woman, had met with a tragic end. They had each been stabbed, it seems, and the Hungarian police were of opinion that they had quarreled and had inflicted mortal injuries upon each other. Holmes, however, is, I fancy, of a different way of thinking, and he holds to this day that if one could find the Grecian girl, one might learn how the wrongs of herself and her brother came to be avenged. We've had more than one story like this. This end with a kind of post-denouement is what I want to call it, right? Like, the climax in the story is that peak of tension, you know, or conflict of the story, and here it's saving the men from the charcoal, or at least one of them. The denouement's the end of the story. That's what happens after a climax. But in some stories, Watson tells us something that occurs even later. You know, maybe I'll call it the post-coital cigarette after the story ends, This story that ends with, like, what Holmes say in the Resident Patient, the sword of justice he talks about in the falling at another time. Mm-hmm. We had it in Five Orange Pips, where we find out the Bark Lone Star sinks with the villains aboard, and in the last episode, Resident Patient, with the villain again. It's a ship, the Nora Crana, lost at sea. I find this an interesting way to end these stories that Doyle has chosen for some of these, and interesting in a good way. I think, like, this is kind of making up for me, this story, in that this is a really, it's not a story of, it is a story of justice, but it's a story of justice in a twisted way. But the big question is it's almost like it gives it a feeling of providence that that the bad guys will get it in the end in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably, given the fact that he failed in stopping them escaping, it's good to know on some level, I suppose, that they paid for their crimes. It also leaves, a big question about Sophie, because Sophie, seeing her brother in that condition and understanding that the man under whose spell she had fallen, or however it's put, was responsible for it, still winds up fleeing with these two men.
Yeah.
You know.
But I get the Victorian,
but apparently here. She's able to summon up the spirit to murder both of them.
In the end, yeah.
But not summon up the spirit to not flee with them in the first place.
Well, she's more under their power then. It could be waiting for a chance, but she's also, that idea of the woman who's already gone off unmarried with other men, which she has already done in the story.
Yeah.
She feels that it's the Beryl Coronet, the daughter in that story, goes off with the villain at the end, even after, tried to destroy her family. She still goes off with him in the end. This case, at least, she does go for her vengeance. Three stories that we've done so far have ended with nothing really known about the escaped criminals. And that's the Engineer's Thumb, where they're just gone. They're gone. Beryl Coronet, we only know that, Holmes thinks that, well, they're just not going to be happy together. Well, so that's horrible, actually, especially for her. And Musgrave Ritual, we don't know if Rachel was guilty, if she knocked the thing down to hurt him, but she still runs away and we don't know what becomes of her. For this story and Five Orange Pips, Resident Patient, we do get this kind of post-annulment where the bad guys will get it in the end. The sword of justice will find them. And that's the Greek interpreter. And Mycroft is nowhere at the end. I wanted them together.
Well, I mean, if you had this in a movie adaptation or something, it would wind up with Holmes and Mycroft in some kind of a conversation about what's going on and that kind of thing. And he just doesn't do anything. It's remarkable if you step back and really look at his contribution to the story, and really all he does is make things worse. He just messes up in this case. And, you can certainly attribute that to the way Holmes talks about him, in that he's more brilliant than I am, but he also doesn't have the, experience or the interest in following up on these kinds of things. Which is true, but when you're talking about the lives of people, a slow death by starvation, and at that point, with all the information that they have, the kidnapping and holding of a woman, no one knows what's happening there, and yet no one seems really driven in this story. The only thing that stands out in the story is the introduction of the character of Mycroft, who then doesn't really live up to the introduction.
Well, or does he? I mean, I think he lives up in the introduction in that he can figure things out and he's brilliant in that way. But because he is this kind of indolent misanthrope, we could call him from the Diogenes Club, that's the big difference between him and Sherlock. This is somebody who can be a hero, and this is somebody you can't.
I have to say, Ed, there's something different about when you're dealing with human lives in the balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just indolence. There's something just wrong with this guy.
Yeah.
And I would love to, I mean, obviously, and this goes back to what I was saying at the very beginning, which is, I think, you know, Doyle at this point is running on empty in the stories. And this is where he gets a little spark of interest, is in the introduction of this character. It doesn't matter about the fact that the guy who is introduced in that way disappears completely. He's there, but he's just following, as you quoted,
mm-hmm.
you know, as well as his great bulk would allow, while his brother and Watson are actually doing all of the heavy lifting. But aside from that, I think that he was a way of trying to inject a little interest in the stories, which were becoming a little bit of a pain for Doyle to write.
He'd been saying that since the first series, though. And
all the more reason.
And he was saying that for Copper Beaches, and then he still comes up with more stories. And then this is the only story that kind of has, I think, not the best for me. So even stories that, you know, I can find little things with them, especially after I've read them for, you know, the 100th time. This story really, I think you're right. It's about, you know, the interest of Mycroft, and then even that. But see, for me, though, even that I find even more interesting, because Mycroft is so unheroic, and that's problematic.
Well, I mean, he doesn't have to be unheroic, but he has to be more interesting. But because you always get the sense that Doyle was never thinking of making Mycroft a real, you know, recurring character. He was a one-off in the second series of short stories to give, you know, some, you know, a little excitement to the stories. That's all it was. I'm sure at that point he never even considered bringing Mycroft mm-hmm. back, but he came in handy.
And he's really he'll wind up really stretching stories too, because the next story is Naval Treaty, which he writes a very long story that he can break into two parts and mm-hmm. have it over two issues. So the Strand can have even, you know, that's
right.
one story instead of two I have to write.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in the next episode. But we get a great finish. So, and I don't want to talk about the finish, but we'll get a great finish to this. And then we'll go one more. So, because one day he does have
to
get Sherlock back. Well, thank you, Curtis.
Yes.
I'm glad I had you on for this story. This has been great. You, unfortunately, won't be able to return for our wrap-up show next month. So this is the last we'll have you on this run of Sherlock Mondays. But you will be back for The Hound. So
if
you register for The Hound, Curtis will be on one of those shows. It'll be really great. So I can't wait to talk about The Hound with you. Thank you for co-hosting some of these. I hope this has been as fun for you.
It's been a pleasure. I mean, it's really interesting, because my usually what I do with these stories is I will read them complete, beginning to end. Study in Scarlet to Casebook, in order. That's the way I do it. So the fact of, because of this show, getting dropped into periodic stories makes me focus more on the stories rather than the book.
And I have to do them from beginning to end. I do every one.
Yeah,
that's been great. You've been on for, you were in Study in Scarlet. You were on, and you even did the you know, the Utah desert part of Study in Scarlet. So well done.
Red, it was not League. A problem. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, Redheaded League, Noble Bachelor, Cardboard Box again, which I still love that story. Stockbroker's Clerk and that Greek Interpreter. Hey, can you think of anything about these that you maybe notice this time around, or
just the focus of them? I mean, because it's not just reading them. It's Les Klinger's great reference library. I look at his annotations. I look at William Baring Gould's annotations. There are different ways of focusing on them, which I don't do when I'm just reading for pleasure. So,
and I find it's interesting that you always then you like at well up until now you every now and then whatever it is you start at Study in Scarlet and you just read them all through,
right?
Don't skip around.
So I mean, when I start the adventures in a reread, I read all of the adventures. I may then go months without going back to Sherlock Holmes. When I do, it'll be with the memoirs, uh-huh. and I'll read them all the way through. It's just the way I do it.
Yeah. Never try to read them chronologically?
No.
Like the Baring Gould has his own chronology.
That's his chronology. Yeah. That doesn't mean anything to me now. I mean, it meant something at the time because I found it fascinating, but it's not the way I would read it.
Well, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. See you at Hound.
Yeah. Sherlockians, thank you for joining us for episode 26 of Sherlock Mondays. On our next show, episode 27, Anastasia Klimchinskaya returns as Holmes helps poor Percy Phelps recover from brain fever after he allows an important document to be stolen in the naval treaty. That'll be an interesting one to read. I like Holmes's investigation in that, actually. And we find out something about something not nice about Watson's school days either. Thank you to our chat, Mrs. Hudson. Brianna, as always, for managing the live chat links. Thank you to our sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. Thanks so much, Lisa. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of our patrons. You can support the Rosenbach through donation. Your support helps us create more programs like this and also care for our collections. You could also become a member. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. Find out more at our website, rosenbach.org. If you haven't already registered for Hound of the Baskervilles, do so now. And please help me spread the word. Tell people, Sherlockians, people you think will be interested in this, tell them to register as well. Again, let me remind you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, like these videos, listening to the podcast, leave us a review. Curtis, I'll see you again for the Hound.
Great. Thank you, Ed.
I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbach Museum and Library. The game is a book. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays. Sponsored by Lisa Washington. Hosted by Edward G. Pettit. Music by Pleated Gazelle.